It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And every year, the MacArthur Foundation announces a new class of MacArthur Fellows, known colloquially as the Genius Grant. The foundation grants a substantial, no-strings-attached award to about two dozen exceptionally talented individuals every year. And Kiese Lehman is part of this year's class. Lehman is the Libby Sheen Moody Professor of Creative Writing and English at Rice University and author of Heavy, an American Memoir. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. It's dreamy to be here with you. I appreciate it.
Listen, I was scanning the list and I screamed when I saw your name. So I just got to know, where were you and how did you feel when you got that call?
You'll appreciate this. I just finished teaching my morning class and I had to do another presentation on campus in the evening, but I came home to try to take a nap. So I was in my bed and my phone rang. And, you know, I don't know about you, but usually I don't answer the numbers. I don't know, because there's always somebody asking for some money.
It's always a bill collector every time.
And I'm so gullible. Like, though, it'll be some sort of scam and I'll fall for it. But it was a Chicago number. So I was like, man, this might be one of my cousins. So I picked it up and the person started saying something about MacArthur. And honestly, I was just like, what? Stop playing on my phone. Who is this? And then the person told me again, and then they read the description of the work I do, and I just didn't believe it. I'm going to be honest with you, fam. Like, I didn't believe it, and I didn't believe it real talk until yesterday. I just didn't believe it.
Can I just say, Kiese, that in every good way, that is the blackest genius award story I have ever heard.
You're like, playing on my phone. I was just like, please stop playing on my phone. Because if you keep talking, I'm going to start believing this. And if I believe it and you lying, like, it's going to hurt my heart. You know what I mean? But at the same time, because I'm a writer, like, I was like, if this is a joke, and I literally thought Reginald Best was playing a joke on me, because we talk about this kind of stuff. I was just like, if it's a joke, you know, it's a great joke, but I'm going to need you to stop doing this because I got to go teach. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it felt. That's what happened.
Okay. So many things I love about that. And in part also that it came in the middle of a teaching and lecturing and events day. I mean, that's kind of the life of an academic, right? You're doing this creative work, but then you got to pause and go talk to some babies about, like, here's just how here's how you bring a story out of yourself. How do you connect those pieces of who you are in any given day?
Yeah, that's why I love you asking me that question. I think it's about accepting, like, who you are. You know what I mean? Like, one of the things I loved about Ms. Melissa Harris-Perry's show was, again, like, the way you taught. And, you know, I'm a teacher. Like, I kind of write because I need to teach. And I teach because I need to learn. And so, I mean, it's poetic and it makes sense that if I were to get that call, I would get it, like, again, in between classes. But nothing about this is like, sensible. Do you know what I'm trying to say? So for me, it was just like, I didn't accept it, but I had to go do this other thing. And then I got very panicky. You know what I'm saying? I got panicky thinking, what if it is true? Because if it was true, you know, like, I'm a big, big fan of self-sabotage. And I probably would have found some way to self-sabotage it if I actually believed it. But I didn't actually believe it until yesterday when it really went out. And then I was just like, okay, so I got to recalibrate some things. You know what I'm saying?
Can you say more about your experience of self-sabotage?
Oh, my goodness gracious. You know, that's been a big part of my life, for pushing that back. And you can see it with this. Like, when I did accept it yesterday, one of the things I do when I self-sabotage is, instead of thinking about what it took to do what I did, I think about the people who made it hard. I foreground them. And then I foreground the people who I think deserve something more than me. I think those are both kinds of self-sabotage, because it halts your ability to accept and sit in the psychological, physical, emotional space that this new thing has given you. And I don't know how to sit in a space that somebody said, here's $800,000 to do whatever you want because we love your work. That I need to accept that was given, and I need to accept that somehow I earned it. But it's hard, because it's easier to be that person who didn't have $800,000. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that I'm not complaining. Please give me. I'm just telling you, emotionally, psychologically, it's just hard to carry that stuff, like, because I don't think we have a lot of models of how to do it. And people who do it, I think, self-sabotage in another way by being private about the failure. You know, I'm private about my failure. That's what I try to write. I try to write it out. But yeah, like, this is a wonderful, incredible thing for me, my family, my community, my friends. I think Black writing in general. But I think we also have to accept sometimes that self-sabotage comes with a lot of these so-called gifts.
What you just said, that sometimes it's actually easier, at least easier in that we know the story of how to not get it. I am very good at holding up in petty corner and being like, look, now, see, no one's ever invested in me. And, you know, like, she got, he got, right? And not that I even, you know, would do that outwardly, but like in my own spirit, right? That it's easy to either see and amplify your own faults or see and amplify the blocks. I'm wondering, because as you're speaking, I was like, well, that's heavy. And then you said, I do try to write it out. Talk to me about how you have been writing it out.
Yeah, like for me, you know, the thing I do lean on that I know is not going to ever fail me is my writing practice. You know, I do it every day. I know it's not going to be good every day. And I revise every weekend hardcore. And so when I wrote this book called Heavy, you know, ultimately I knew I had to write it to my mama because she was a person who I think saw me for the longest and also saw me in ways that I didn't want to be seen. And I think I saw her in ways she didn't want to be seen. And honestly, like, we had just gotten to a place with different forms of addiction that was untenable, meaning like both of us wasn't going to make it, like, because we were just giving away every quote unquote blessing we had. And so I just wanted to use the art or the gift that she gave me, which was writing and revision, to write into that relationship and connect that relationship to the nation's like obsessive need for so-called progress. And often that obsessive need for progress comes in the way of like shrinkage for like different kinds of Black bodies. And I was, you know, I used to be very, very anorexic, incredibly body dysmorphic. And so I just wanted to write into that, but also just talk about how when you write into the body, especially if you're writing into the body via a direct address to someone who loves you or loved you, you're going to sit in things that you were afraid to sit in. And honestly, like, I wrote to my mama because I needed somebody to go on that journey with. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Like, I needed to hold my mama's hand through that book. And so a lot of people are like, oh, it was so brave of you. I'm like, fam, like, I couldn't have written that book if I hadn't like written to my mama because I was too scared to. You know what I mean? So that's the truth. I never said that actually, but that's the truth.
One of the things we share is being Southerners. I've been in New York all week and will be here sort of through much of the rest of next week. And my team said to me this morning when I walked in, they were like, oh, you know, how are you enjoying your week? And I was like, oh, I just need to go home. Like,
yes, indeed.
I was like, I need to go outside. I just need to be outside for a second. Talk to me about the ways that your work reveals something about Black Southernness. And what that rootedness in Black Southernness is for you?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I mean, I think my root in Black Southernness, and particularly like Central Mississippi Black Southernness that was created and cradled by Black women, my grandma, my aunties, and my mama, for me, it's just like a site of absolute paradox. You know what I'm saying? Like the most horror in the world, I think I've experienced in different parts of the South. But revelation and absolute joy, you know, come from living in the South. And like, I don't want to live anywhere else but the South. You know, like, I live in Houston now. I live in Mississippi for 5 years before that. I was in New York for 20 years, 15 years before that. But, you know, it's also tied to that thing we were talking about, you know, how sometimes we can hide from ourselves. It's harder for me to hide in Mississippi because I think that the culture and the history and the people actually see you and literally say hey to you, and I think sometimes want to hear the stories. So I think that's it. I think sometimes, you know, we need to accept that we come from a place where people actually want to hear stories, like when you pass them in the street. And I actually want to hear stories. You know what I'm saying? Like, New York is incredible. Some of the most incredible people in the world to me live there. But, you know, there's so many people. You just can't look at people in the eye and listen to them. Or people think you want to fight them or step to them or, you know, mack on them or something like that. So I just like being home, fam, where you can breathe and you can see out. I'm not trying to idealize it, but it's familiar. But it's also, I think, like the cradle of like direct action. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we do is about direct organized action, whether it's literary or actual action, you know, so.
Yeah, no, it's not idealized. And the comfort goes in and out. But there is a kind of and perhaps it doesn't feel this way for everybody, but as a Southerner, it just feels like, oh, this is mine. I think it can be tough for Black folks in America where the land isn't ours, right? Where there is always that sense of disconnection. And yet for me, the South is the place that feels most like this feels like mine.
Yes. And the thing that I really love about our South, I'm just going to say, I might be speaking just for me, but like, I love that. Like, I was born in Jackson, and every Black boy, girl, genderqueer person I know born in Jackson has one foot in Jackson and one foot in the rural community that their grandparents or uncles or great grandparents. So like we literally are straddling like these country supposed rural urban lines. And as a storyteller, I think that makes some like much, much more lush storytelling. It's not like the story of the city versus the country. I mean, that, yeah, you can get that, but most people straddle. You know what I mean? And most people who leave the Deep South in these little country Black towns aspired not to go to New York or Chicago. Like when I was coming up, they aspired to go to Jackson. You know what I'm saying? to Birmingham. You know, maybe Atlanta.
Maybe.
Maybe. But for real, fam, like I just think like that straddling of the rural and the urban like can open up some lines literally that I think I don't see open up a lot of other places.
We'll be back in just a moment. More on The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. And I'm still here and straddling some critical lines between urban and rural, between Southern and non-Southern, with Casey Lehman, author, professor, and one of the fellows of the newest MacArthur Foundation class. I want to talk about something that you did that's kind of astonishing. You got your rights back to two of your previously published books, Long Division and How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, and re-released them. You did it in 2020. Why?
I got my money up and I had the money to do it from hustling and selling these books and going all over the place talking. And two, it was because I signed one of those like, you know, no limit literary deals. You know, I gave my first book away to the publisher for $1,000. It's called How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America. And then I gave my novel away for like $4,000, and I gave all the rights away. So I had to buy my books back because I wanted to do something more with those books. Those books were never published the way I wanted to. And after 5 years, I thought a lot about a lot of different things and came to a lot of different conclusions. And I wasn't comfortable with my name being attached to some of those conclusions. Like some of the things that I said about Kanye in the first version of my essay book. Like I couldn't sit behind that. You know what I'm saying? Some of the stuff I said about Michael Jackson. And it wasn't about those people. It was literally about my changing. You know what I'm saying? Like I was a different person who no longer wanted to have my name attached to a literary artifact that was connected to some of what Kanye West was doing, for example. And I didn't want to be connected to that person who bought my books for $1,000 and $3,000 anymore. So the person, instead of giving me the books back, the person was like, oh, you can buy them back. And I was mad as hell. And then I just bought them back and put them out the way I wanted to so I could control the film rights, the TV rights, the international rights. And it actually, I saw rappers do. So I was just like, you know, I always wanted to be a rapper. So like, this is the most rappish thing I can do, get in a terrible deal and buy myself out and then brag about it. So that's what I tried to do.
Okay. I love that you said that, because I was about to be like, well, now you sound like a rapper. But there's something else that it sounds like, right? So, you know, here we are, people who are creatives, right? We create this thing that we put out into the world, and it exists far beyond our reach and control and even our capacity to revise, which is terrifying. But also because the thing that we make isn't a thing, right? It's not a widget. But by owning the rights, it's, you know, again, it feels very Southern. It's like you bought some land, son.
Yeah, that's exactly what it felt like. I mean, you know, and we come from people. My grandmama never, you know, she finished high school through like correspondence courses, worked in a chicken plant her entire life, worked as a domestic, but she had land and a house at 18 or 19 from working around and getting some money from the church. And she brought the man who she chose to mess with into that house, into that land. So we didn't have a lot, but what we did have was ours. And I didn't, those books were in the world, and that's how I got my start. And thank goodness people read any of them, but they weren't mine, real talk. Like, I was renting those books. And I think that's a terrible feeling once you accept that, especially if you come from the kind of deep South that we come from.
All right, here's my final question. You got your money up a little bit. You got some books, you got some rights, you bought some land, son. Now with this honor, with all the things that it is, including the resources, you got any ideas about the use of those resources?
Yeah, like I'm about to spend the next year getting my head right, fixing my body, and hopefully trying to be here for a little bit longer. You know what I'm saying? Like I had excuses before this to make work really my only hobby. And for the next year, I'm gonna use some of this MacArthur money to making my body not hurt so much, making my head a little less cloudy. I'm just gonna give a year to just trying to get some sense of joy back into the joints and into my head. So I'm gonna take care of myself for a year, take care of my family, and then I'm gonna get back to work.
KSA Layman is about to discover the joy of the nap ministry. He's a writer, professor, and 2022 MacArthur Fellow. KSA, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. You're a wizard at this, fam. I appreciate it.
Thank you.